a real 22. How long were you in this small transit camp at Timini?
Oh, just a few days, as far as I can remember. My memory's failed, really, in this bit. The chief thing was that about that time I lost track with my two best friends, Jeff Chambers and Frank Bush, who I never saw again. And I can't remember really when we were parted, but it was somewhere about that time. After a day or two, we were put into trucks and transported along the coast road through all the famous places we've heard such about, Benghazi and all the rest of the famous hunting grounds. And we arrived at a place called Homs, which was quite near the coast, because we had seen the sea. And there we were stuck into a barn. They seemed to, from memory, be barns. Some way around them, but mainly just big barns where we went in at night and hung about in the day.
Were they feeding you all right?
This I can't remember much about it. I think the thing is, at that time we were still under, we were numb at the thought we'd got caught, and we hadn't started to learn the next art, which was survival. And I can't really remember. Only thing I can remember about Homs, I can remember two things. One, I got a nasty spot on my back, and the medical orderly, there was a chap there with no equipment, but I forgot whether it was a needle or a razor blade, whatever, or the heaters it in a flame, cut this bit on my back and got out the tiniest little bit of metal, which I was very proud of. I said, oh, well, I've been wounded. It's a little tiny, but it had raised a nasty, I can remember that. And when I got back, somebody had pinched my great coat. So that's my recollection of Homs. From there, we went on to the first camp that we were in, a place called Tahuna. Brick, single-storey buildings, small rooms at the end, and a large communal room. I was in a room there with one or two more South Nuts as well. George Atwell, who'd been to my old school a few years before, an old man down. Don Walker, one of our high school men who hadn't come to Octu. And Jack Sykes was with us then, and whether he joined us, I don't know. He'd been wounded, he'd been treated, and he himself can't remember, but he was with us in this room.
What state was he in?
All right. I didn't even know he'd been wounded. I can't remember. As far as I was concerned, he appeared in my memory, and he was okay.
Now, what was in there? You were in single-storey sort of huts.
Uh-huh.
What were the facilities in there? I mean, what was a bed or things like that?
No beds. We must have been issued with a blanket or something at some time, which, again, I can't remember when, because we sort of had something between us and the floor. And as I say, I'd lost my great coat. Washing, there were taps, typical army things at the top of the compound. Between each hut there was a barbed wire fence so that they could, the Italians would counter every morning, and they'd block off one hut and count the people, block it and come on to the next one. Cold water. Some of the people there rapidly deteriorated. People let themselves go.
In what way?
They wouldn't shave, wash, or what's the use, And we did try to maintain the soil as best we could. The food was lousy. We had to do an issue with a bowl and a spoon. And the day we got we called a loaf at the time, which was a largish cob, And around midday or so, we'd get a bowl of, well, soup, flavoured with tomato puree, little bits of olive oil, and a few bits of macaroni floating in it. Occasionally it would vary with a few bits of vegetable. An odd time, not every week, about once a week, a little tiny issue of cheese, a little square of cheese. Cheese had always upset me at home. They used to literally make me sick when I'd been at home, but it didn't make me sick there. I think I'd have eaten horse if they'd brought it in. But I actually learned to look forward to a little bit of cheese there, which I've liked ever since, which I must say the first time I tried it, I was very apprehensive. But as I say, the food was pretty awful.
Now that's not enough to keep body and soul together. Did you start to lose weight on that?
We must have done. Yes, we were what you might call gently starving. It was, as I say, they were pretty awful.
Had you been officially registered yet? As POWs, you know.
The first registrar, in fact I know because I've still got the card, was dated the 24th of June. So I must have been in Tahuna then. And this was a standard card where you crossed out the bits. I have been wounded, I have not been wounded. I am well and being well treated by the Italians. But that was dated the 24th.
And that was sent to your parents?
That was sent to my parents. And also at that time, they issued cards which you could write on. And there were so many per compound, nothing like one each. And we also got a cigarette issue. I think it was 5 a week. And one fellow who we'd become acquainted with, nothing else, offered to sell me his car for 5 cigarettes. He was a married man with a family too, but apparently it was more important to have a smoke than let his wife know it was all right. And on that card I simply wrote the names of all the South Knox people, my particular friends. I simply put like myself, Walker, Sykes, and I put Fred's name on. I do know that because my parents visited his mother. Yet I can't remember Fred in the camp at all. And I sent that home, and I did find out a lot later that my parents had contacted all these people, made sure that their folks knew they were all right. But that was all the sort of correspondence we had. They gave us various forms to fill in, Red Cross, with Red Crosses at the top, which you had to be a bit careful. We were warned that some of these questions weren't strictly now according to Geneva Convention. But we filled all these films and things in anyway for the Vatican and the Red Cross and all the lot.
There was no chance of getting any parcels at that stage, though?
Not at home, no. In fact, on this card it says that you'll be able to write to me when I'm in a permanent camp. So they didn't regard it as a permanent camp.
Were the prisoners helping run the camp, the cooking and things like
yes,
that?
Yes, the prisoners were cooking. There was a lot of competition, of course, to get in the cookhouse. And both Jack and I remember that there was a South Knox man in the cookhouse and can't remember him at all. It didn't. If it had helped us more, we'd probably have remembered him. But we spent most of our time there, as I say, determined to keep our spirits up. We had a pack of cards. And John Walker, who was quite a good class bridge player, taught us to play bridge. He'd spread the cards out on the floor with all the hands showing and taught us to bid. I can remember the Culbertson system, which has long since fallen into, that's as historical as my own instances. But we did learn to play this game, which occupied quite a lot of time. One of the other notable things in that camp that I can remember, they had people give talks, And they did have a doctor who was allowed in now and again, and he came and gave us a talk, partly on medical matters, such as if we sat in the sun for an hour, and there was vitamin D or whatever it was in the sun had helped to keep body and soul together. There were a couple of chaps there gave very interesting talks on Russia. The first one or two, they were talking about, they'd both been to Russia, these fellows, and they were talking about what a marvellous place it was and how everybody, you know, got treated well and all the rest of it. And I went to one talk, and they were advocating that we had the senior British officer there was a warrant officer, class 2, who was a bit senior to our George Attenwell. And he was in charge of the camp. And they're advocating that we set up, we needn't bother anymore about the army's authority is gone, we should set up people's committees. And at this, I was suddenly tumbled to it that these were a couple of communists, which had never, I must admit, I hadn't really sunk in. One of them was a manager at Marks and Spencer's, but he declared he was taking good money from the rotten capitalists. And he declared that he was quite willing to lead a people's committee or whatever and take charge of the camp. And then one or two of us, we went and saw this sergeant major, and he said, there's nothing I can do about it. It was a tank, a corporal in the tank.
Was it Ramelson, Bert Ramelson?
Can't remember.
Because John Walker and Bert Ramelson, we've interviewed both of them, and it seems to have been Ramelson was with you at that time.
I can't remember his name, but...
What did you think of him? There's the communist philosophies he was putting forward.
It was very interesting at first, but I was quite... I thought, oh no, when he wanted to take over, and of course the cookhouse was mentioned, of course. And I know I was not the first when I went to speak to the sergeant major in charge. He told me, he'd already been told. And he said, I know what he said to me, he said, I'll show the bugger I can't do anything. And he simply got the Italian commandant and slammed these two in the cooler for a fortnight or something. We heard no more about the takeover. But it was very interesting.
Would you actually debate with them? I mean, talk about...
Well, when they started this, people did ask them, you know, well... For instance, this thing about why work for Marks and Spencer if you're such an ardent communist.
Was this the corporal in the tank corps that worked?
There was a tank corporal and his pal, I think, was an ordinary, whatever they are, in tanks trooper. But they're a right pair of, as I say, looking back, you know, they're really, I think the main thing was to get hold of the cookhouse, quite frankly. There were some wild rumours flew about that camp. One day, they'd taken some fellows down to the local village to get vegetables. And they declared they'd been approached by what was obviously an Englishman in Arab dress who wanted to know how many prisoners there were, how well it was guarded, and we could see ourselves getting out in a few days. Whether it was true, I just don't know. But reading books afterwards, long-range desert groups, Popsky's private army and these people did get an awful long way into the desert, but as far as I was concerned, it was, you know, there were all the rumours.
What would you do? I mean, so that you'd spend the day, you'd have this roll call in the morning,
then
you'd spend the day playing cards, anything else?
One chap in the room with us used to spend most of his time writing recipes up on the wall, meals he was going to have. Which usually included not only rice pudding, but bread and butter pudding and treacle pudding. The main, as I say, food was our main object, but then we'd learn that what we'd got to do from then on was survive.
Were there any sources of extra food you'd worked out by then?
No. That place was, as I say, there wasn't, people were so hungry, there was no trading for bread or anything, they wanted all they could get. The other thing, we all got lousy, which was most uncomfortable. Bore out all the stories my father had told me about in the trenches in the First World War. Horrible.
How did you try and control them?
taking your clothes off and going through. We weren't wearing many clothes, but they got into the seams. The Italians helped. They're making the rule almost have a head shaved, well, not shaved, but put the clippers right over and kept your hair cut absolutely, you know, down to stubble. But it was a miserable time.
What about the latrines? What were they like?
They were rough and ready. As far as I can remember, you know, nothing very sanitary. Had a shower now and then. They'd take us to have a shower. Across the other side, there was a square in between the compound, and across the other side were some South Africans. And I was there once when they got some South Africans in the adjoining shower bay, and they started fighting amongst themselves. The Boers and the English speakers, they were always at it. Even the commandant was a little tidy man, colonel, had an interpreter. It was something out of a Damon Runyon. So it's straight from the Bronx. And every day there'd be something wrong. You'd have a roll call, and then this chap would step forward, the colonel would rant at him. The colonel says us how, if you don't get your shoestrings done up, you don't get no food. The most regular thing was to stop your cigarette ration.
He was an American Italian.
He was American Italian. So really, as I say, him with his shoestrings and his suspenders, where people had, you know, the trousers wouldn't hold up. You have to have some sort of suspenders. As I say, it was a pretty good sort of place.
Did the Italians treat you well or badly or what?
Well, I suppose it was well as they could. As I said, there were these petty things like stopping this cigarette ration and, you know, they'd maybe keep you in the hut for a couple of hours because something had gone wrong. And,
what sort of thing gone wrong?
Oh, if they didn't think it turned out for the count quick enough, or all sorts of stupid things.
Was there any actual physical abuse? I mean,
No, you didn't see much. You'd see an Italian. As far as I can remember, there weren't any actual towers around there. They'd walk around the perimeter. The barbed wire was only fairly low, but massively thick. And we used to walk every day. We used to walk round and round the compound. We used to make a point of having some exercise.
Were there any gay sports?
Oh, no, nothing. No, there wasn't room. You were kept. The wire was fairly close to these buildings. But there was room to walk around, and that was the thing we did. We walked around, played cards and chattered. George Attenwell, who was quite a man about town, told us where we'd been missing all the pretty girls in Nottingham. And the chief thing, of course, was all the good cafes in Nottingham. Everything, the talk invariably went back to food. And that was Tahuna.
Now, how long were you at Tahuna?
Till sometime in November. And by this time, we'd begun to get quite excited. We'd had one or two new prisoners come in, and we'd heard about the big battle, and we'd actually heard the name of Alamein. And I always remember one man coming in, and he'd been shot up after he'd been taken. He'd only been prisoner 2 or 3 days. And he'd been shot up by British Spitfires, which, of course, in our time, they hadn't been able to fire them. So I knew they hadn't got a long range anyway, so we thought there was a chance that we'd be getting out, because from all accounts, of which they were coming up the desert like fury. And this must have been about a month after Alamein. So we began to get, I remember, you know, spirits began to lift quite considerably. But
what was health like in the camp? I mean, were people, you were losing weight a bit, but...
Diarrhea, bit of dysentery.
What do you think caused?
The latrines were holes in there. Now I come to think, there were buildings, and there were holes like they have in these Arab countries, with footholes each side. But there wasn't much. Those who got it badly, they did take one or two people away.
What do you think caused the dysentery?
I suppose lack of solid food.
So how did you, in November you moved, how did that come about?
It all happened ever so quickly. One day we were there, and the next we were told we were moving, we're on trucks, and we moved up to a place just outside Tripoli. I've forgotten the name. Some people didn't know, some people had been there some time. It was another camp, but we were only there a couple of days or a day and a night. And then we got to one of the rottenest times I'd ever experienced in my life, when they put us on this wretched boat in Tripoli Harbour and announced we were going to Italy. We got on the boat, or ship I suppose I should call it, cargo ship.
You don't know its name?
No. I think it must have been some relative of the Bounty. It was an old cargo steamer, and they put us on in the day. First deck down, the hatch cover's wrong. There was a thing in one corner of the hatch cover, about a yard square, with a ladder leading up to the deck. The latrines were along the side of the ship. Wooden things they'd put there with holes in, and they'd screw the wash over the side. Was fairly dark, even the daylight, as you could imagine. You know, big hatch covers and canvas on the top, and then this little square at the corner. And we sailed in the evening. And like my other previous Mediterranean cruise, it was lovely going in the harbour. Tripoli had quite a big harbour wall, a bit like Dover, as I remember. And it was quite, and then all of a sudden we're out through the entrance, and of course the ship was empty, and it pitched, and you could hear the propeller come out of the water and race. They'd given us rations. It had a couple of rotten, mouldy ship's biscuits, quite large things, you know, 2 or 3 inches square. And one tin of the Italian equivalent of bully beef, which were actually like you'd get in these tins of stewed beef. They were about as big as a small Heinz bean tin. And that was the rations. It was only Naples wasn't far away, you know. But, as I say, as soon as we got out of this harbour, this wretched ship plunged and pitched and rolled, and there's a howling gale. We'd been badly fed, and of course, to a man, everybody was sick, and we were crowded. However we managed, I do not know. But it was horrible. And the voyage, which was a few hours, lasted several days. We got over the sickness, in fact. And tried these biscuits were as hard as iron. But of course, that once we got over, most people got over the sickness, say the storm had died out after the first day. And then, of course, eat your biscuits, and of course, the first of the meat, and it had gone. Getting out at night was absolutely. Everybody, of course, had to. Always had to go to the latrines for one reason or other at night, and of course it was pitch dark. You could just see a little tiny, and now I was at one of the far corners of the hatch, which was most uncomfortable because there was another hatch below and it had a raised cover, and it was some way to put your head on, but every now and then somebody would tread on you, and when you walk around, somebody tread on people, and to find your own place when you went back meant usually involving waking up the people you were with. Who by this time, there was John Walker, Jack Sykes, and myself, who I knew.
So the others, you...
Somewhere, and this I can't... Apparently, I've spoken to Fred Langford, and he said they called names. And they called him B. they called him Frederick Coombs, his second name being a family name, Coombs, and they declared that's how he got separated from us. But I literally can't remember him in the camp at all. But, as I say, we finished up there with just three of us out of all this bunch. We'd lost our Sergeant Major, George Atwell. Then we were on this rotten, heaving, pitching ship. It was a bit more cheerful after a day or two when it turned fine.
Were you worried about being sunk by the British Navy or Air Force?
But when you think we were worried, you should have heard the Italian. Every now and then there'd been the most awful yelling and stamping, running about on deck. Once I did manage to get out, they'd usually kick you down. I got out and had a look. And the big panic, I was no great spotter of Italian seaplanes, but this was an Italian flying boat. And they were doing the nuts. Oh yes, it began to get quite worrying. But eventually, we came to the end of the voyage, and this rather curious, because after all this wretched, hunger, seasickness, and then the cramped conditions and everything, went up one morning, and we're in this beautiful bay. It was absolutely, I couldn't really do justice to it. It was frosty. I've got a pair of shorts, some socks, and I can't remember if I've got boots, and I've got a hat, my side hat, still got my cap bag. And there was this most beautiful blue bay. We're passing this gorgeous island sticking out, an Italian seaman, someone standing near me. Of course, I didn't know a word in Italian, but he said Capri, which I did know. And this was, as I say, one of the most spectacular sights I've ever seen in my life. White houses, coloured houses on this as we approach. This huge volcano pursues us in the background, smoking gently. This beautiful frosty morning. And I stayed up till they kicked me down the hill. And I remember I was absolutely frozen, but it really was the most, I knew then why they said see Naples and die. It was absolutely, as I say, even though I was hungry and starving, it really was the most spectacular sight.
What was your reception when you arrived in Naples from these civilians?
We did, actually the ship was rather curious because thinking back, we must have stayed on the ship all day because I can distinctly remember that going up to the latrines at night, you could see the glow over Vesuvius. You could see this dull red glow lighting up the smoke cloud which hung over it. And the next morning, they did start to disembark us, and just before we disembarked, I remember seeing a German officer with all the silver lace and things, and since he was carrying a staff, whoever the field marshal was, I don't know, but he was marching up and down the quay, followed by a huge entourage of people not gold lace, they seemed to go for silver lace. And then we're off this rotten ship onto the quay. We were bundled and shoved along. We went into a place where they gave us a shower.